Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
Today, my guest is Anil Seth. He is professor of neuroscience at Sussex University and creator of the TED Talk called Your Brain Hallucinates Your Conscious Reality. Anil, a warm welcome to the show on leadership. Now, I fully understand that you may not consider yourself to be an expert on leadership. In fact, I don't consider myself to be that either. I tend to stay away from the word expert. And still, I will maintain that the work you're doing has profound implications for how we think and talk about leadership. And I'd love to explore that with you in this conversation. But before I sort of dive in with the first question there, I was wondering, maybe since I alluded to the title of your TED Talk, Your Brain Hallucinates Your Conscious Reality, for the listener who may not be familiar with your work, who has not seen your TED Talk, would you please kind of set the scene for that title?
I can try. I mean, the first thing is, by the way, thank you for inviting me on, and I'm really happy to have this conversation and see what these... what we can both learn by bringing what I do together with what you do. Nobody gets to choose their title, right? Whether it's a TED Talk but this is the first thing I learn about titles. Some people take the title of the talk, Your Brain Hallucinates Your Conscious Reality, to imply that actually nothing is real and everything that we experience is just a figment of our imagination. And that's not what I mean. What I have in mind, and what I explore in the talk and in the book and my work in general, is the idea that everything that we experience, and I'm fundamentally interested in the nature of consciousness and how we experience the world around us and being a self within it. And the line I'm taking to try to understand this pretty ancient mystery really is, instead of looking for some magic pixie dust that you sort of sprinkle on the brain and bingo, you get consciousness, to think about what conscious experiences are actually like and why one is different from the other, why a visual experience is different from, let's say, an experience of self. And then that leads to the problem of perception. How does the brain make sense of the world and of the body and of the nature of self? And if you start with the world, it seems obvious, right? You open your eyes and there's the world full of colors and shapes and people and places. And it doesn't really seem as though our brains have all that much to do with it, but of course they do. And if you think about from the brain's perspective, it's locked away in this bony vault of the skull, and it's dark in there and it's quiet. All the brain gets are these electrical signals, which are only... they're noisy, they're uncertain, they're indirectly related to what's out there in the world. So the brain, the way I've come to think of it, it's not a new idea, this. The brain is always making its best guess about what's out there on the basis of this noisy sensory data and its own, if you like, expectations or beliefs about what's happening. Now, in mathematics, statistics, we call this Bayesian inference. But informally, it's just like making a best guess. Mm-hmm. And the specific idea is that the brain is always making predictions about the sensory data that it's expecting, whether it's coming from the eyes or the ears or the heart or the lungs. And these sensory signals aren't read out to form some picture of the world. They're used to update or calibrate the brain's inside-out, top-down predictions. And then the claim is what we experience isn't some sort of readout of the world from the senses into the brain. It's an inside-out, top-down, active construction that's calibrated by sensory data. So that's what I mean with the title. I mean, the actual word I use more often is controlled hallucination.
Yes.
That perception is a kind of controlled hallucination. It comes from within, but the control is equally important.
Yeah.
Evolution has trained our brain so that it has a close grip on the way the world is. So it's not all made up at all, but it is constructed, it is created, it does come from within.
And by extension, I guess you could argue, and I suspect you don't disagree, it is highly subjective.
Yeah, I mean, almost by definition, if you exactly. try to say, well, what are we talking about when we talk about perception or perceptual experience? It's happening for an organism, you know, and that means that I don't know and can never know what it's like to be you or somebody else.
Yeah.
Let alone another animal or some other conscious creature. So it's intrinsically subjective. That's right.
Yes. And I think that's an important, because I think this is where the relevance, of especially for leadership and human interaction, becomes sort of really foregrounded, because we often think we're looking at the same thing. We use the same words to describe the thing that we think we agree on. But we may not at all be looking at the same thing. We may not be talking about the same person, even though we think we are talking about the same person. And that's where there's all sorts of noise that's introduced in our interactions. So you mentioned the Bayesian and statistical probabilities that conjures up an image of a machine. An unbiased, maybe imperfect, but unbiased machine, almost like a little scientist who is just looking at the data and continuously calibrating. But I'm wondering, is that, how accurate is that? Do you mean to suggest that the brain is without bias? Because in my interaction with people, and certainly I'm not immune from it either, it seems sometimes there's an almost willful ignorance of the facts when they fly against their perception, their reality in the moment.
Definitely, I'm not saying that we're sort of unbiased in any degree. In fact, this whole framing of what the brain is doing in terms of Bayesian inference or making a best guess, it's something that really builds in bias from the ground up. It does so because in this process of inferring the causes of sensory signal, of making a best guess, the whole idea turns on, you can't just look at the data. You have to look at the data through the lens of some prior beliefs or prior expectations. No. This whole thing about inferences, another way to frame the problem is like, given what I believe now and I get some new data, how should I update my beliefs? That's another way to put it. And if you think about the brain doing that, yes, it's sort of behaving as a scientist in some way. But of course, scientists have their biases too, including me.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of these great idealistic views of science that, no, we just look at the data and reality reveals itself. No, we always come at the world with biases, whether we are scientists doing experiments or whether we're a brain trying to figure out, you know, what's on the table in front of me. I'll give you one example of a bias that we all have in our brains and we don't know that we have it typically, which is when the brain is trying to make sense of shadows,
mm-hmm.
often it's a bit hard. You know, the pattern of shadows on objects could be compatible with many different things going on, but one disambiguating factor the brain uses is the bias, the prior belief that light always comes from above. And that makes sense, right? The whole mm-hmm. evolutionary history of brains, the sun has always been in the sky. I mean, maybe behind a cloud, but it's always been somewhere in the sky. It's never coming from underneath our feet. So it's a very reliable assumption to make, and it's kind of a quick fix. It helps the brain make sense of things, but it is a bias. If light was coming from beneath, as it can do in the modern world, you know, we can be on the top floor or something, our perceptual system may lead us astray. And the important thing about these biases, and I think this goes all the way through, is that we don't know we have these biases.
Yeah.
We see with them, we don't know that we have them.
Yeah.
And that's where they can be very useful, but they can also be problematic when we don't realize the role that they're playing.
Exactly. And now we got really kind of getting at the heart of the matter from my perspective. And of course, bias is a bit of a charged word, especially in today's context.
Yes.
Right? Today's sort of geopolitical shifts around DEI and things like that. But you might also, instead of bias, I think if I'm hearing you correctly, you might use the word shortcut.
Or heuristic.
Heuristic, exactly. Absolutely. Or mental model. And I like to use navigation as a sort of a metaphor for it. Our navigation devices are extremely useful, but if we trust them blindly and if we confuse the navigation system with the actual territory, we might actually drive into a railroad tunnel. Right? There are limits to the accuracy. The map is not the territory. And I think that's what you're saying here. The brain relies on maps to spit out predictions of, where to turn. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting that, in one sense, you're saying the map is not the territory. We shouldn't confuse a metaphor with the thing itself. Now, of course, this whole view of the brain is itself a kind of metaphor. The idea of the brain as this hypothesis testing, little scientist doing, that itself is a map of the territory of the brain. And I think it's a useful one, but actually one of the joys of working as a neuroscientist is constantly probing at the limits of these metaphors that we have and trying to dig beneath them to figure out, maybe the brain is actually doing something a little bit richer, a little bit more complicated, a little bit different.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that because I'm hearing sort of in casual conversations creep into our language statements like, well, my brain was just trying to do X, right? That they're attributing an intention to their own brain as if it's a complete standalone, phenomenon in which they have no stake.
Right, like the dishwasher or something like that.
Yeah, the little homunculus, the little man inside of our head pulling the strings. And I've heard you also say the brain is trying or there's an intent.
I think that is a probably straining the metaphor. The brain just sort of does its stuff. When we say we're trying to do something, often we mean there's a conscious intention. I set a deliberate goal and I attempt to achieve it. I don't want to import all of that baggage into describing what brains do. Yeah. So it is a bit metaphorical. The brain, in a metaphorical sense, is trying to figure out what's out there in the world when it's doing perception.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean the brain sort of has this conscious thing like, oh yes, here's some light. I need to figure out how, what to do with it in order to figure out, whether it's a mug or not. It's just doing what it's doing. But evolution has shaped our brains so that they do certain things. And I think it can be helpful to describe brain mechanisms as having some sorts of goals. We understand there's a famous quote by the biologist Theodore Dobzhansky who says that nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution. And another way to think of that is if you want to understand the function of a biological system, we need to understand that in light of what it evolved to do. And that licenses a way of looking at things that says, there are goals. Our biological circuits, systems, brains, organs have goals. The heart is trying to pump blood around the body.
Yes.
It's a metaphorical way of thinking about it,
yes,
but it's useful in understanding the function.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for setting that context. So we all have, at the risk of introducing another metaphor, these tools in our head, right? We have the presence of this thing that we call the brain, and it's just sort of doing its own thing rather autonomously. It's spitting out predictions I was about to say trying to make sense of the world, but that's not what the brain does. That's what we do. How do you disrupt that pattern? Because that can obviously, from your perspective, based on the research you've done, how can you disrupt a perception loop or this, maybe in the context of a group where we have this group hallucination, we're all coalescing around the same thing that just isn't real. How do you snap out of that? What's our responsibility?
Well, good question about responsibility. I think that depends very much on, you know, this context of what a group might be trying to achieve. But I think there's something, I think there are ways into the important question that you raise. I think of it sometimes in terms of perceptual habits. We talk about habits often in terms of things that we do, routines we might fall into. And sometimes these are useful. They're behavioral heuristics or shortcuts sometimes. Yeah. But they can also be problematic if they're, you know, if they just get stuck and they don't meet the moment in one way or another. And we think a lot in general about how we form new habits, good habits, and how we break bad habits. Typically, they always have to do with action, but I think we can apply the same way of thinking to perception. You know, perception is not this passive act of registering the world as it is. It's an active process of construction that's unique to each of us. So in a sense, we can say we all have perceptual habits, ways of seeing, ways of hearing, that like many habits, they get so baked into us that we don't realize that we actually have these habits.
Yeah.
And if we want to change how our behavior, one way to change our behavior is to change how we experience things. Instead of just trying to focus on the output side of what people do, why not focus also on the input side? If we experience the world and the self differently, then behavior can change very naturally as a result of that. So the first way into this, I think, is to realize that perception is this constructive thing, that we don't see the world objectively. Neither do we see it randomly. It's also not a case of anything goes and any way of seeing things is equally valid. No, that's not true. You know, if I see a bus where there isn't one or don't see a bus when there is one, probably more worrying, that's not a good thing, right? No. So there's got to be a connection with the world. But there are many equally valid ways of seeing the same situation or ways that might have differing value. And really, I think just trying to bring home this realization that the way one person experiences things is not the only way of experiencing it. And you don't even have to go into the sort of the territory of, let's say, neurodivergent conditions or anything like that. I think we all experience the world differently.
Yeah.
And maybe the differences are quite small, as we may not even realize them because we'll still use the same words. But it doesn't mean they don't exist. And the key thing, I think, is to recognize that that other ways of experiencing things are possible and nobody's perception is fully objective. And I think if that is really understood, and you can do this, you know, with simple visual illusions and all kinds of interesting examples, that opens a space for that you can play with for all the kinds of things that you mentioned.
Yeah. So sort of acknowledging that nobody has a monopoly on the truth, if you will, kind of opens up a possibility for some inquiry, some curiosity. But let's say we have somebody who every time that he's confronted with, you know, a hypothetical person when he's confronted with somebody in a position of authority who gets angry, that he completely shrinks. Right, he has sort of this system shut down, and he's almost transported back to when he was a young kid, berated, whatever. So there's an awareness that this behavioral response habit is not working for me. Assume that this person has just heard, hey, it's in the perception.
Yeah,
I'm seeing it. What would be your recommendation for where to start?
It's difficult. Like I don't claim to know how to solve these particular problems for in particular cases. I think for me, what I noticed after years of thinking about these ideas and working on them and talking about them in various ways is that just catching myself in the act of perceiving every now and again. It's a little bit like a form of meditation. I'm a rubbish meditator. I'm not nearly diligent enough to do meditative practice regularly. But there's some overlap between the more scientific, philosophical perspective I take and where meditation might bring you, which is this recognition that experience doesn't give us a transparent window onto the way things are. No, it's something that we do, that our brains and bodies do. No, if you're having a strong emotional response, in mindfulness meditation, one of the recommendations is, instead of immediately ruminating about the causes of feeling angry or upset or whatever it might be, you pay attention to the experience of the emotion itself.
Yeah.
Locate it in the body. You know, where is it? Is it in my hands? Is it in my chest? Is it in my head? That tends to diffuse it of its power, and you sort of you just explore the emotion, and you don't let it lead you directly onto the thought and then the action. You try to break the habit by just catching the perception as a perception. I mean, I use this a lot when I go swimming in the English Channel here, especially at the moment. The water's still very, very cold.
Yes.
And we have this natural response, like you get into the water that cold and you think, ah, oh, this is intolerable. I need to get out. I need to get out. Yeah. But once you do this a few times, you just learn to pay attention. And I tell myself this every time, just pay attention to that sensation. It's just, that's what your body feels like when it's cooling down. It's actually not intrinsically unpleasant at all. Yeah. It's just, you've got into the habit of interpreting that perception as meaning something. But if you just return to the basics of what does my body feel like when it's cooling down, things become possible that weren't possible before.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, make the shift from thinking something to recognizing that a thought is showing up, and just allowing the thought and the emotional response to be there, but recognizing that it's I don't know, my words, it's just data, but it's not necessarily the truth.
Yeah. I mean, it's like not ignoring everything. So. Yeah. It's back to when we were saying that, yeah, no one has a monopoly on the truth, but it's also not the case that anything goes. Right? Yeah. All of our experiences are there for a reason, but they don't necessarily reveal things directly as they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And in your writing, you mentioned that these, I guess, these predictions that the brain continues to generate, which sort of disguises itself as reality, these predictions are based on two things, if I understand you correctly. One is past experiences, and the other is expectations of what's about to happen. Is that accurate?
Well, I think there's actually a range of these expectations, priors, that are present for many reasons over many timescales. So evolution bakes in expectations at a very long timescale.
Yeah.
This is a bit like the expectation that light comes from above.
Yeah,
I mean, that's been so stable that it's something that is kind of hardwired into our brains. It's very hard to overcome, although in fact you can. One of the interesting studies in neuroscience, not from my lab, was with enough training, people can learn a different prior, even on something as basic as light coming from above. But in any case, you've got these very long-term priors, which have some amount of flexibility, but not very much. Then you've got our own lifetime experiences.
Yeah.
You know, from being very young to what happened yesterday. And then, of course, we've got our moment-to-moment experiences too. So, you know, I walk into my lab next door to this office, and I have an expectation of who's going to be there, where the desks are. And that's not stable. That might change from day to day. But that's an expectation which can help shape my experience at that moment.
Yeah. And the reason why I wanted to sort of zoom in on that just a little bit is because, well, if I just look at those two things, the past experiences and the expectations, I can't really do anything about those past experiences. They're there. They're sort of hardwired in my system, in my memory banks, and it would be silly to sort of swipe them aside. But I can do something about expectations. I can adjust my expectations, or I guess I can engage in some sort of self-talk. If I'm really dreading a meeting with an employee, I can have a conversation with myself beforehand. I can catch myself with a negative assumption about the outcome. based on prior experience, I can sort of catch that and go, you know what, I'm going to try and set a different expectation. I'm going to tell myself there's a possibility that this can be a really a wonderful outcome.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I haven't, it's a good framing, I think. I haven't, to be honest, thought too much about how this works when we consciously project alternative possible futures. But yeah, I think that can help. But by the way, I think, you know, although we can't change what happened, our memories do change. Now, I think one of the other ways in which we get misled if we overextend the metaphor of the brain as a computer is memory being some kind of filing system. And we have the memories there and they stay exactly as they were until we pick them out again whenever. Human memory, animal memory, biological memory is not like this. Every time we remember something, it's also an act of reconstruction, not construction for the first time, but reconstruction. And there's a decent amount of evidence in psychology that the more often you remember an event, the more the memory begins to change and actually begins to drift. So there's a sort of irony here that the things that we remember more often actually may become less accurate than things we don't bring back to mind often, very often at all.
That's actually really hopeful because, you know, if we look at sort of the stricter version, which may not be the one you subscribe to, but a version that says, you know, the brain is just sort of doing its thing autonomously and we have no influence on that process. It's just doing its own thing.
Well, hold on now. I'm going to stop you there because that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, there's when you say we have no influence on what our brain does, I mean, you are your brain, right? It's very, very, I mean, you're not only your brain, but there's no separate you that is distinct from your brain that sort of can be controlled by or control it. It's part of what your brain does anyway.
But that is why I'm bringing this up, because those are conversations I pick up on and I fall prey to them as well. Right? It's almost like, well, the brain is just this sort of limitation that we have to deal with. And it doesn't give a lot of hope, you know? So I was looking for place, where can you intervene? The expectations is one. That's where you can actively intervene. You can sort of practice the meditation principles of catching yourself in a thought. And what you're bringing in now is you don't necessarily have to take past experiences as unchangeable facts.
No, I think this brings up a lot of interesting topics, actually. You know, I think we fall into this fallacy of things being unchangeable too quickly. And I think that's problematic. We see this also a lot in mental illness, frankly. You know, one of the symptoms of depression is this sort of belief that things will never change, or if they do, they'll get worse rather than better. The space of possible futures seems to shrink in states like this. But things are not all that fixed. Our brains are remarkably flexible. Some kinds of change can only, I mean, okay, not everything can be changed, right? I mean, this is true. There are going to be some limits on what changes can be made. But the changes that can be made, they're in several categories. So some of them only happen just with sort of exposure and practice, not with any sort of necessary cognitive thinking about it. So these experiments where people were trained or learned to expect that light comes from below rather than above, they just have to be exposed to a lot of examples of light coming from below. There's not really a shortcut, but nonetheless, things still can change. We trained people in my lab to be synesthetic a few years ago, so to have color experiences when they looked at black and white letters. And that took weeks and weeks, but we were able to change people's experience down to the level of the colors they were experiencing, which was very interesting. And then there are changes which you might be able to either make or accelerate through some kind of cognitive framing. This might be the kinds of things we were talking about. How do we manage not to get dragged along by some emotion down in some well-worn path of negative thinking and just experience the emotion as an emotion, experience the context we're in as the context without drawing conclusions too rapidly. I think those kinds of things can be learned too. And then absolutely, you're right that another thing to add to the mix is projecting back, or not back into the future, projecting out into the future, so that we have another set of priors and contexts for interpreting data. So yeah. Some data, you know, much of the data that we get, I'm using the term very liberally, most of the signals, like a bodily state or something like that, could be compatible with many different things. And if our only way of interpreting it is a negative way, well, that's just going to be what happens and what's going to keep happening. But some things might have a different interpretation. There's one really famous experiment that I think speaks to this, which was from the 1970s. You probably couldn't get ethics to do it anymore. But it had university students, male students, crossing one of two bridges. It was by these people called Dutton and Aaron, I think, in 1972. And there was a scary bridge, like high above a raging torrent. It was a very rickety bridge. And there was a very boring, low, solid bridge. So you go over one or the other. And the idea is the students that went over the scary bridge, you know, their heart rate would rise, their adrenaline would start getting going, their cortisol would get up. It's kind of an anxiogenic situation. But at the end of the bridge, there would be an attractive female experimenter, person in on the experiment, and she would sort of ask them a few questions, and she'd also give them her phone number in case they had a follow-up question. And what happened was a lot of the students who went across the rickety bridge ended up calling the girl, asking for a date, whereas people who went on the boring bridge didn't. And the explanation for this, you know, this was a 1970s era explanation, but I think it's kind of compelling, is that the very same physiological states, which might normally have been interpreted as, you know, this is aversive, this is anxious, this is scary, was sort of reinterpreted as, you know, romantic excitement. Because the context changed.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You change the context, you change perception, you change state. It seems to be all interwoven. So you describe an experiment where, you know, going over this high rickety bridge is obviously, you know, going to be perceived as dangerous. It's gonna lead to a change in your internal state, your emotional state, your mental state. And so in that sense, perception drives state. But then once they're in that state, the notion of calling the girl didn't seem so threatening anymore. So it sounds like maybe, you know, mental emotional state also drives perception.
Well, there's just always a loop. I mean, we tend also to fall into the trap of linear thinking, right? Yes. We sense something, we think about it, and then we act on it.
Yes.
In biology, you rarely find these kinds of linear phenomena. Everything is looping back on itself.
Yeah.
When we perceive the world, we're also acting on it. A lot of our perception is about driving bodily movements so that we can perceive things better or do something differently. It's a constant loop. And even the state of the body is itself a kind of perception. The brain has to infer the causes of the sensory signals it gets from within the body. And this is another part of what might be going on in this bridge experiment. Because the brain's basically trying to make sense of why is the cortisol level suddenly shooting through the roof. And, you know, one way of explaining, interpreting that data is, well, I'm on a scary bridge. But another way is like, oh, actually, it's because I'm excited to meet this person. So there's, and then that will change the nature of the state of the body too. You know, especially when it comes to emotion, you know, the brain has a very top-down effect on the state of the body too. Of course, the brain is continually controlling the physiological state of the body. So there is a very, very tightly coupled loop between perception and control, both within the body and more broadly outside the body as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that reminds me of one thing I came across in your book. I think something like perception and action are something like fully intertwined or inseparable, I think is what you said. Perception and action are inseparable. Is that right?
I think most of the time, yeah. I mean, not 100% of the time. When we dream, mm-hmm. our perceptual experience is pretty much wholly decoupled from
yes.
our actions in the real world. We're still yeah. acting in our dream world often, yes. but our experience of what's going on is not compatible with what the real physical body is doing. But perceptual systems in general, I think, you know, evolved totally in conjunction with action. The only point yeah. of evolving a system of perception is in order for that perception to guide action.
Yeah. And
so every action that we make changes yeah. our perception too.
Exactly. And so that what that suggests to me, because there's so much focus in the world of work in general on behavior, that we tend to just want to correct the behavior. Whereas what I think the implication of what you're saying is every action you see somebody else do, every action you see yourself do, is a reflection of how the situation shows up for you. It's a reflection of the perception. So if you want to change the behavior without, imposing yourself or right, some sort of imposition of force, it's probably much more fruitful to look at, hey, what was he or she, what were they, what was I seeing, hearing, what was showing up for me in that moment? And maybe that's where I need to look.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's not the only place to look, but if the only place you look is on the output side, you're missing half the game. You know, if you work on the input side too, then some output changes might follow naturally.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. You know, a good example of that comes to mind is there was another classic study of how fielders in cricket caught the ball when the ball's flying over their heads and they're running to catch it. And of course, expert cricket players are really good at this. They'll end up in the right place to catch the ball. But if you ask them how they do it, they often don't really know. And you know they don't really know because they'll probably say something, but what they say won't match what they actually do. They might say, well, I figure out where it's going to land and I run there as quickly as possible and then I catch it.
Yeah.
But if you look at what they actually do, it's not that. It's not that. What they seem to be doing is running in such a way that an aspect of how they perceive the ball is very tightly controlled. It keeps something like, and I forget the details, something like the tangent or the rate of change of the tangent of the angle of the ball to the horizon
wow.
is constant.
Somebody figured
yeah.
that out.
So, yeah, yeah. No, it was actually one of my colleagues at Sussex, Zoltan Dienet.
Wow.
He did a fun experiment
wow.
on what crickets actually do.
Yeah.
And if you measure how where they run and what they're looking at, you can figure it out. And they do something like that. But they have no idea that that's what they're actually doing. But that is what they're doing. And that's really interesting because they've learned to perceive something in a particular way. It's like keep something constant, right? If you learn to keep something constant, you just like then you end up catching the ball.
What a wonderful metaphor for leadership. Look for the constants. And if you learn to see something as constant, you might catch the ball, whatever that represents.
So, yeah, I guess you could drop in as many, probably, what
yeah.
I think of as sometimes leadership, like have a North Star or something. But, you know, when you've got something to anchor to and
yeah.
what we're generally very good at as biological creatures is things like feedback regulation.
Yeah.
When we've got something and we can kind of continually adjust to it, we tend to be pretty good at that. That's what biology in general tends to be
yeah.
pretty good at. So, yeah, that's another way of thinking of it.
Yeah, and the reason why I'm keying in on this is because, typically, people are fully aware when there are struggles at work with other people or other groups, other whatever. But they and they'll go to a leadership course and they meet maybe somebody like me or one of my colleagues, and they'll say something like, or they'll ask something like, "Tell me what to say or do to fix this. I'm stuck." So they know they're stuck, but in their framing of the issue, they have projected the problem outside themselves. And the implication of your work is start with your own perception. You as the leader, whatever leader means in this case, it could be parent, it could be, it could be anyone, any human being really. But if you're getting stuck in certain situations, then your perception is where maybe you need to start looking.
Yeah, I think it's worth considering both, right? Ultimately,
yes.
You know, if I change my perception but don't do anything about that, then nothing is going to change. But changing, or at least noticing that the way I'm seeing things, whether it's a situation at work or wherever, noticing that the way I'm seeing that is an interpretation and it's not necessarily the way things are,
yeah.
That may make it easier to then do something about it. And maybe doing something will follow actually fairly naturally.
Yeah.
Once you take that step.
And that brings me back to what you mentioned earlier, that you know, about teaching people about new priors, if I say this correctly, right? Sort of desensitizing them to their particular heuristic, that even with light coming from above, you're able to sort of train a new pattern simply by exposing them to an experience that contradicted their existing, I'm using, you know, probably not the most accurate words, but I hope you, right? Confront them with experience that contradicts their belief about the world.
Yeah. I think another exercise that I found useful in these kinds of situations is, do you remember that photo of a dress that half the world saw as black and blue and the rest of the world saw as white and gold?
Yes. And for the reader, that's an article in the Scientific American. Highly recommend you reading it. Yeah, but please continue.
But I think it's a nice example because now, I remember this was about 10 years ago that this image first hit the internet, and I'd never seen anything quite like it. And I think actually many people working in my area hadn't either. It was an example of an image that people didn't just see slightly differently. They saw it very differently and
yes.
fell into these two camps. Yet it's clearly the same image. So I think it provoked a really interesting and quite mind-opening discussion, that if you found people who saw it different ways, but they can clearly also see that they're looking at the same thing, it becomes very apparent that, oh, well, you know, how can you see it another way? Like, it's clearly black and blue. And then, of course, the other person is saying the same thing, but for white and gold. And eventually, you know, after some dialogue, you hopefully get to a place, instead of having a massive fight about it, you know, you get to the recognition that both interpretations are valid. And that can be a very, very useful way into this necessary recognition for everything that we've been talking about, that our experience is not the one true experience, the one true window onto reality as it really is.
Yeah.
Maybe you could train people. I'm sure you could train people who saw the black and blue dress to see it white and gold. Probably people have done that.
Yeah.
Now.
For the life of me, I was not able to see it as black and blue. I tried. I was stuck in white and gold. I couldn't do it.
There you go. So you and me are different. Yeah. We'll never be friends.
We'll never. Yeah. But that's actually a very hopeful note, and a great one to close on. You know, recognize you don't hold the monopoly on truth. And when that sinks in, I think it's especially for people who really want to, you know, do better, it automatically opens up windows for inquiry.
And you know, the thing about the reason perception is a very, and things like this example of the dress and other visual illusions are useful here, is I think because they tend to be much less threatening, right?
Mm.
If you describe a situation that already involves social dynamics and emotions and consequences for people's jobs and lives and so on, it's difficult to give up the idea that the way we see things is the right way, because you know, it can be a very uncomfortable place to be.
Yeah.
But if we have this fun example of a dress that looks black and blue and white and gold, you know, there's not that much writing on it. There's not that much at stake.
It's not
threatening. It's a nice example where you can get people used to the idea.
Yeah, non-threatening and still very unsettling.
Absolutely.
Yeah. On that note, Anil, I want to really thank you for your time and your insights. Much appreciated you joining the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Learned a lot too.
Bye-bye.